This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to another in our special summer edition of A Big Country, where we're bringing you some of our favourite stories from around regional Australia. I'm Edwina Farley, thanks for your company. This week we're cruising the Murray in a houseboat, meeting some of the people who call this waterway their permanent home. We visit a daylily farm in the Sunshine Coast hinterland. Did you know you can eat the buds? Meet a former fly-in, fly-out mining engineer who's ditched the high-vis gear to become a chicken farmer. And join Peter Jones on his daily rounds to check the rain gauge, a job he's been doing literally off the cuff for 52 years.
I record that reading on my shirt cuff. It washes out.
Don't you get in trouble from your wife for that, though?
No.
Why on earth do you write on your cuff?
Well, what else have I got? If I put it in a piece of paper, I forget to take it out and it goes through the washing machine, and that's what upsets wives.
Well, it certainly does. Always pays to check the pockets before putting the washing machine on. We'll join Peter Jones at his home at Orford in Tasmania later in the show. But first, let's kick back and relax and go messing about on the river.
Good afternoon. How are you going, Lynn?
Catherine, I'm very well, thank you.
And this is home?
Yes, it is home. Mobile home.
Do you mind if I take a look?
Not at all. Come in.
Have you ever dreamed of living on a houseboat? Not just for a holiday, but spending every day out on the river? Well, it's a way of life for quite a few people who call the River Murray their permanent home. Hello, I'm Catherine Hoytzenroder. The lower reaches of the river are perfect for messing about on boats. The river is wide and smooth, and the houseboats can travel up and down its lengths through a series of locks and weirs. What's the go with that gangplank there?
That gangplank there is can be treacherous sometimes.
We've made it across. Wow, look at this.
Everything you need to live a normal life, just able to untie and move off whenever we have the inclination.
Today I'm catching up with a few of these river dwellers to find out what draws them to a life on the water. First up, it's retired PE teacher Lynn Davison and her husband Ron, who have moored their custom-built houseboat at Berry in South Australia's Riverland. They moved onto Linny's tinny at the start of the year and have already discovered the benefits of waking up on the river every morning.
The view for a start, I mean, you can't beat waking up to that. And in the evening, some of the sunsets are stunning, particularly when you move away and you're out upriver or downriver, you wake up and sunsets and sunrises are beautiful. Freedom. You can just untie and go whenever you, if you feel like moving anytime, going for a trip, untie and go. It's take everything with you.
What went through your head when you started to have this idea, Ron, of having a houseboat and living on a houseboat? Did you have any concerns?
The biggest concern I think we've got is age, because living on a houseboat tends to be a bit more active. You've got to do pumping out yourself, water you've got to look after, gas you've got to look after. So you've got to be, and it's fine, we're both fit and healthy, but the big fear is what would happen if something would be to happen to one of us, yeah.
Moored further upstream from Lynn and Ron is Rodney West. The 73-year-old has weathered more than 20 years on this boat, which he built himself. It's a much more humble affair than the modern houseboats which ply the river today, but it's given Rodney a unique lifestyle.
I've travelled the river from one end to the other a couple of times, you know. Recently just come back from Gawler for a trip down there, but keep me off the streets.
Well, you're moored here, really nice spot here at Lirrup.
Yeah.
How long have you been here for?
16 years we've moored in here. You're out of the wind, you've got the deep side of the river, and you're only a couple of kilometres from the town. You get all the signals for the phones and so on, you know, the internet and all the rest of it, so there you go.
A potbelly stove keeps Rodney warm during the cold winter months on the river. He has solar panels on the roof and a generator for his electrical needs. He also keeps chooks and grows vegetables on a block of land that he owns near the mooring.
I know I've got 12 volt on board, everything's 240, the fridge and everything else, and it's all 240, you know, and TV and the rest of it, you know.
Yeah.
So,
we're so not... you, because I've heard you, I mean, you're playing your radio, so you'll run the radio,
on
you,
240,
you can, yeah. Yeah, and the TV.
Yeah, 240.
Do you have any aircon? What do you do when it gets really hot?
Out the window. And luckily, I've got a swimming pool outside my back door.
So when it's 46 here in the Riverland, you just
go for a swim about every hour.
Yeah,
that's about all I do.
Do you have any bricks and mortar investments, or is this
no,
you know, is this
nothing.
This is home? This is everything.
This is it. This and this piece of land. Yeah.
What would cause you to leave the boat and to move into a house?
Death.
So this is it. This is where you're living. This is where you're living out.
How am I going to improve myself? I've looked at it plenty of times. How will I improve myself by selling up here and moving? And I can't see any improvement. So, you know, this is it. Mm. Now take me out boots first.
It all sounds very idyllic, but sometimes the dream lifestyle can turn into a nightmare. A few years ago, an uninsured houseboat sank in the River Murray, leaving its owner homeless, broke, and facing hefty fines if she didn't remove the wreckage from the water. And even if the houseboat does stay afloat, it's unlikely to increase in value in the same way as a bricks and mortar home. Joanne Seaton and Steve Kitty understand only too well the downsides to living on the water, but they wouldn't have it any other way.
You don't do it to make money as you would with a house or hope to get some capital gain. Every year it is worth less, I guess. But the lifestyle was just fantastic.
So how did you make that decision, guys, to move on to a houseboat?
That's a very long backstory. we've always been involved with the water, water skiing when we were younger, sailing for 30-odd years. We actually built a catamaran to sail off into the sunset, and that didn't work for a whole range of reasons, but sold the business and decided we wanted to come up and be with our kids up in the Riverland and didn't want to live back on a... you know, land. So we decided we'd get a houseboat built, and this was built in Loxton about 8 years ago. You come home from wherever and it's like you're on holiday.
So that feeling, I mean, you've been here how many years now?
Six
and a bit. So that feeling of being on a holiday, that hasn't sort of eroded over time?
No. No, well, we're sitting here now looking at the view on a chilly winter's day and lovely and warm. It's just great. We just love it. Mm.
Yeah, no, it hasn't changed. As I said, Steve built a 42-foot catamaran, did all the electrical and plumbing and whatnot, and we lived on that for about 3 years, and we just loved being on the water. So, and this is a lot bigger than our catamaran, so it's, you know, really comfortable.
Mm. Yeah, I guess, excuse me again, I guess the thing is, it's a minimalist lifestyle, but we'd already done that, so we live that way anyhow, but you can't have four wardrobes worth of clothes. I think a lot of people in some of the rental houseboats expect that you can have a normal shower for 15 minutes and all 10 of you can do it and you're not going to run out of water. Well, we've never had that issue because we've lived in a yacht and whatever, and so we're aware of that. And so showers here are luxurious. It's just like a normal shower for us. So
mm-hmm. It's very private.
Yeah.
We just shift across to the hotel over there on the dinghy and our little putt-putt thing. And, whenever we can sort of avoid driving, we take the boat somewhere across the football club we used to.
So if you want to go and have a meal at the pub, you just get in the dinghy.
Hop in the dinghy, yep.
Yeah, we had friends over from Tassie and we did the same thing. We just took them for a putt-putt up and down the river and then across to the hotel for something different. They loved it.
Good morning, chickens. I think 10 years ago, if you said I was going to be a chicken farmer, I would have said you were crazy. Working out at the mines and working in the automotive sector prior to that, and I never envisaged being a farmer, let alone a chicken farmer.
Have you got a secret dream of throwing in the day job to do something that you really love? What would it take for you to give it a go? An injury? A redundancy? Hi, I'm Natalie Fernbach. Well, this was the situation facing former fly-in, fly-out mechanical engineer Dan Cordner. 2 years ago, Dan was offered a redundancy from his mining job based in Townsville, North Queensland. He and his wife Leanne took the redundancy as an opportunity and set up a cane and chicken farm in Ingham.
We've got about 140 acres on farm. Right now we've got about 450 chickens running around in our paddocks over the back. We run a mixture of the chickens and sugarcane on the property.
So what prompted the decision to actually make that tree change?
There's quite a few things. We were living in Townsville at the time. I was working in the mining sector and there's a bit of a change come up in the employment status there. And we'd always been interested in the food system and where our food came from. And we had one of those opportunities come up where it was a decide to keep working Monday, Friday, Monday to Saturday, or to, yeah, give farming a try. We were in a financial position where we could afford to do it for a couple of years. It's been very liberating getting to spend every day with my kids for the last 2 years straight, and with my wife for the last 2 years straight. I really didn't think it would happen, that we'd have that opportunity. We'd always dreamed about doing something else and having a block of land and growing produce for ourselves and for the community. But actually being able to do it, yeah, it's been an amazing couple of years so far.
One big stumbling block to developing their Bellisato chicken farm has been the lack of abattoir facilities to process the birds. Their solution has been to build their own at a cost of several hundred thousand dollars.
Yeah, for us it was a showstopper in a lot of ways. There is no poultry processor in North Queensland that will do small batches of birds. We were passionate about running poultry, so we really had to build our own. If we wanted to do it, that was the only way we could go.
So you've set up your own abattoir. What's that process like to just dispatch these chickens that you've raised since they were chicks?
Yeah, the day our chickens go to the abattoirs, pretty tough. For us, we're connected with the bird from day one. So when we receive the tiny little fluffy chicken as a day old chick, through to the moment, we take its life and then convert that into a product for people to enjoy. It's a very tough day, that last day, but it really connects us with our food. It's very different to putting it on a truck and sending it away and then having it come back the next day packaged in a bag. For us, it's all at our hands from day one right through to when the customer receives the product. So, yeah, it's very powerful.
What kind of options are there for distribution here or for you to sell your product?
The ice cream van sitting just beside us here is our distribution option. Again, there's not a lot of frozen transport in products. Because we are such a small-scale producer as well, it's difficult getting anyone to stop in and pick up our goods and distribute. So we really are right to the customer's door. So later on this afternoon, I've got to do a drop-off at a restaurant in Townsville. So,
can you tell me a little bit about the breed that you're running?
Yes, we're running Summerlad chickens. They're a slower-growing heritage breed of chicken. They take close on three times longer than your conventional Ross or Cobb broiler that the rest of the Australian chicken market's built around. We did run we bought 200 Ross birds early days, and they're a very sedentary animal. They really just eat and then sit down on the ground and don't do a real lot. We had them on grass as well, but they're really selectively bred over decades to basically be raised in barns. They enjoy 26 degrees temperature. They don't like getting very far from their food and water. So they're a real hard bird to become affectionate with, which sounds funny in terms of being a meat product at the end of the day, but yeah, we're still human. We still have that attachment to our animals. Whereas the Summerlad birds, right from a very early age, they're out there foraging, they're tearing around the paddocks. They're a more, I guess, natural chicken. It's a bird that's lived a good life in the time that it's had, rather than growing so quickly it can't support its own weight. And I think, yeah, there is a bit of a conscious decision there that people will start having to make as these options come up. Up until now, there hasn't been a lot of choice. Even if you go and buy the best free-range chicken you could buy, there's still a Ross or a Cobb broiler bird. So I think there is the consumer's taking a lot more interest in the food system, where their food is coming from and how the animals have been raised and where they've lived. And that's what really got us into the Summerlad birds as well. But we started taking that interest and asking questions and seeing what was out there. And we didn't like what was out there very much. And this is probably the best. If you're going to consume chicken, buy the best you can buy.
Former FIFO mining engineer turned chook farmer Daniel Cordner speaking with Natalie Fernbach on their farm at Ingham in North Queensland. Still to come on this special summer edition of A Big Country, we're off to a daylily farm. What started as a hobby has turned into a blooming mail order business. And meet dedicated weather watcher Peter Jones.
How do you actually read the gauge?
I take the lid off it and I withdraw the graduated cylinder and I line up so that I can see the meniscus against the graduations. There's a reading. We'll say it's 4.2 today.
You could say Peter Jones is Tasmania's very own rain man.
For the past 52 years, he's been taking daily rainfall measurements in the state, first on the wet and windy northwest coast near Wynyard, before moving to the much drier climate of Orford in the east. And it's all been off the cuff, literally. Hello, I'm Edith Bevan. Over the years, 84-year-old Peter has developed a unique way of recording his daily rainfall figures.
And I record, or as an aid memoir, I record that reading on my shirt cuff. It washes out.
Don't you get in trouble from your wife for that, though?
No.
Why on earth do you write on your cuff?
Well, what else have I got? If I put it in a piece of paper, I forget to take it out and it goes through the washing machine, and that's what upsets wives. When I go upstairs, I write that in my diary, a daily diary. And at the end of the month, I go through the diary, flick the pages, and I record it on a form that the Bureau of Meteorology sends me, and I put the monthly, add up the daily figures, get a monthly total, and I duplicate that for my own records. And I send the original off to Bureau of Meteorology. That's all there is to it.
Peter's interest in the weather was sparked as a young 18-year-old when he joined the Navy. It was his job to take the four hourly readings.
I was a bosun's mate, and his job is amongst that to man the gangway and to take hourly readings, the mercury barometer and the sea temperature. What else did we take? Temperatures. Wet and dry, as well as ordinary temperatures, and they went in the ship's logbook, and that's where I started. I left the Navy, I went farming. My then father-in-law was an engineer with the hydro, and he was fascinated. He thought it'd be a good idea if I had a rain gauge, and I thought it would too. Actually, I had one, and they called the place, the station, Kelletier, because that's a tiny district behind Wynyard. And that's where my farm was. And so for 33 years, I think it was, I kept the records at Kelletier. And then I sold out and I came down here and I offered my services to the Bureau, but they said, no, we've got a man in just over the road. After a couple of years, that man died. And so I inherited his job and his records. And I've been reading, I think it might be 17 or 18, I'm not sure. But it comes to 52 years of reading.
Do you ever get to go on holiday, though?
Yes. When we first came here, 1996, we were here about 4 months, and we took off to the mainland for 16 weeks. I arranged with one of my neighbours to read the gauge. When I come home, I said, well, Charles, how much rain did we have? He said, no, none. I said, you're mad, man, because I came from Wynyard area where it rains and rains and rains, and when it's not raining, it's raining more. So he said there'd be no rain, and I couldn't believe him. I thought he was having me on. But I've learnt since that he wasn't. In Spring Beach, it doesn't rain sometimes, and it doesn't rain for weeks and perhaps even months. Anyway.
Peter Jones says he has no plans to retire, and the Bureau of Meteorology is happy for him to continue. They've just awarded him a Rainfall Excellence Award for his efforts over the years.
Look, it gives a bit of purpose to life when you're at this stage of life. You know, I often think of what I do as in relation to those dot paintings that the Aboriginals do in Central Australia. Thousands of little dots. One little dot means absolutely nothing. But thousands of dots arranged in some sort of order and with system, and it makes a picture. Well, it is for the rain gauge, because what happens here at South Orford has really no relevance to anything else, but put in a picture with what happens in Orford and at Wielangta and at Sorel and various districts, it helps make a picture. And it needs a lot of years to make the picture. And I'm very proud to be a part of that.
Is it a job for life, or are you eventually going to retire?
Oh, no, I'll keep doing it while ever I can toddle to walk down here and read the gauge. Yes, I don't believe in retiring.
So this is a propagation area that we're in. Always digging, always dividing up, and always replanting, always fertilising. It's a whole cycle, just goes on year after year after year.
There's a bright splash of colour amongst the rolling green hills around Mullaney in southern Queensland. Hundreds and hundreds of daylilies are flowering on just this small patch of ground on Scott Alexander's farm. Hello, I'm Jennifer Nichols. Daylilies are prized for being hardy, long-flowering, drought-tolerant perennials. Some have a beautiful scent, and the buds even grace the menu of one of Australia's best restaurants. Scott Alexander got hooked on the flowers more than 40 years ago. What started as a hobby has turned into Australia's largest mail-order daylily business.
In 1976, I moved from Brisbane to teach out at Yarraman, and a lovely neighbour across the road gave me a couple of plants and said, "You haven't got these in your garden." And I said, "Well, what are they?" "Daylilies. Daylilies. No, never heard of them." So that was the start of the love affair when I saw that they repeat flowering. And then I found out there were seven more colours, and then there were 700 more colours, and so on. And so I got hooked, and my hobby turned into a business. And it's been a business now since 1984, when I retired from school teaching.
I understand you've got the largest mail order daylily business in Australia.
Yes, we are now the largest ones. You know, the collectors, the daylily specialists have become old and retired, and there's not too many of us left, unfortunately. They're not as popular now as they used to be, but that's simply because we're not getting the exposure that we had before. So here is a big garden bed where we have divided up newer daylilies into lots of little pieces, and then we've planted them out. Once we end up with a couple of hundred of them, we start marketing it to nurseries and to our mail order clients.
Are some of those hybrids that you've created over the years around us in this paddock now?
Oh yes. In the case of this lemon one, it's called Mullaney Lemon Delight. It's very appropriate to the colour, and it's a delight to look at. We've got Mullaney Apricot Nectar because it's an apricot and because it's fragrant. Another one, In Excess, which was my first really fragrant daylily. It's got an excess of petals and it's got an excess of fragrance. Then one called Shocking. Shocking won the Melbourne Cup. It's a shocking colour of gold and black, and I just felt the name was appropriate at the time.
How do daylilies go in terms of their hardiness?
I think they're one of the toughest perennials there are. The summer bred for the northern parts of America and Canada. I've even sent daylilies to Anchorage and Alaska. They'll show you how tough they are. They can grow from up near the tropics and that, as long as there's some chilly nights in winter, right down into the coldest parts of Australia. So they're very versatile. You've got little ones, and you've got medium size, and you've got large ones.
This is something really interesting you're talking about, that they are edible.
Yes. For years I've eaten petals, I've eaten the little roots that they develop when I'm digging them up, little white roots. The buds have got a slight peppery taste. The petals, well, they're just a lovely sweet thing to nibble on. It's full of vitamin and minerals.
And your daylilies are gracing the plates of one of the flashiest restaurants in the country.
Yeah, that's a nice little bonus for me. This is the Key Restaurant. Peter Gilmore, a well-known chef in Australia, that's his restaurant, and it's down by the overseas terminal in Sydney opposite the Opera House. We deliver daylilies once a week to him. This is a degustation dish that he produces. So, yeah, it's nice to know that my daylilies are down there being eaten by connoisseurs.
Once upon a time, you were a much larger operation. Now you've got one staff member full time?
Yes, we've just got Joel now. The global financial crisis affected a lot of nurseries. It changed our industry completely, really, and a lot of nurseries have closed down. So we just have this acre and a half to 2 acres and just one employee, whereas we had five before. Joel works his heart out trying to keep this going out on the farm here. I do the mail orders, write out the labels and bring them over to Joel, and we discuss where plants should be dug from or planted in new beds and things like that, and he just about runs the place here.
What would you like to say about daylilies to everybody who's listening?
Well, I think if you're a gardener, whether you've got a small garden or a large garden, or you live in an apartment that's got a sunny patio or something like that, I think there's a place for daylilies. We've supplied hundreds of daylilies of one colour to councils for large landscaping jobs. They're stunning to look at for 6 weeks, 2 months, and then they flower again. The fact that a lot of them will flower again in autumn, I think, is a real bonus. You can't help but fall in love with them.
Scott Alexander got hooked on growing and propagating the flowers more than 40 years ago. What started as a hobby has turned into Australia's largest mail-order daylily business. Amazing stuff. Thanks to Jen Nichols for that story from Queensland's Sunshine Coast. And that's it for another week on A Big Country. Join me, Edwina Farley, and the team at the same time next week when we'll bring you more story highlights in our special summer series. Until then, bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.